Now you want to talk about reading? Let's talk about reading.
Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
The book served as a passageway to the evil worlds beyond.
Ready to go, Doc?
Oh, yes, my dear fellow. I'll just check the gyroscopes.
Hello, and welcome back to the Appendix N Book Club. And today we are on episode 107, covering Ellen Kushner's Swords Point. And with me today is the best damn swordsman in the world, Saint Hoy.
Only if you offer me an interesting contract.
And we are also joined today by writer, poet, musician, gamer, streamer, and the co-host of the Queerly Yours podcast, Angela Lemus Mogrovejo. Angela, thanks for being on the show today.
Hello, Angela.
Thank you for having me on for this. My partner passed along this little opportunity to me, and I was like, yeah, that sounds awesome. And it gives me an excuse to actually start reading books again, because it's been a while in the midst of our current global situation where energy is a bit of a hit and miss kind of situation, to having an excuse to be like, okay, sit down, read a book, just see what happens. And the results, I think we'll get into in a bit, but it was nice to have that experience of at least at some points of reading the particular book that will be the topic of our discussion, have that childlike level of like, oh, I want to see what happens next. Mind you, it was not all the time while I was reading the book, to be fair, as a full spoiler to my opinions of the book for the rest of the podcast, but it was nice to have an excuse to just be like, read a book, see what happens. It was good to have that happen again.
Absolutely. Well,
glad we could offer that.
And I'm excited to hear your thoughts about it. But first, can you tell us a little bit about so on this show, we ask all those cliche questions that every RPG podcast likes to ask. And that first cliche question is, how did you get into gaming?
Well, I got into gaming with possibly one of the worst starting off points for having any sort of interest in tabletop role-playing games, if we're talking about gaming in relation to that kind of space. Because my first two experiences with gaming, I believe, were a Star Wars RPG and Dungeons and Dragons 4th edition. But my friends were not very good friends. They're the kind of friends who, like, when you look back, you're like, oh no, these were terrible people. Don't ever actually be friends with these people in your life, in your adult life, ever again. And my first experiences with gaming were very much defined by one incident of playing a Star Wars RPG where we played and they specifically built me a character whose equipment they told me up front was terrible, and the likelihood of the success of the equipment rolling what I needed to make it work was low. And then the first session, I get a crit, and the person who has the badass bounty hunter stand-in character fails so badly that he uses his jetpack and crashed up into the ceiling of a cave we were fighting a droid in, whereas my character like one-shot a droid. And I'm like, there is justice in the world for this. There in fact does exist divine order in the world, and it leans towards I'm right. But that was my first experience. But the first sort of proper, like, oh, this is kind of a thing to get into was, in retrospect now, not a group that I would ever support ever again. But it was initially watching actual plays of Critical Role. And then from there being like, oh, I want to try 5th edition, because my partner, also being a game designer and more coming from an indie and story game perspective and approach, started to get into those kinds of things and was like, hey, hun, do you want to try this out? And I'm like, I don't know anything about Dungeons and Dragons. I've just watched a show about it, but sure. And then I just kind of sunk my claws into it, and I started doing the thing that I think my mother would have been proud of, which was that I'm a writer, and I grew up absolutely hating the kinds of books where the first 30 pages are a huge expanse of world building and characters. And I was like, oh no, now I want to world build. Oh no, now I understand why people like doing this, because it's the most basic way to indulge your, well, that wasn't very good, it should have had this and this. You know what? I'm going to go do this and make my own world where I get this, and you can do this, and there's not these terrible things that, why did you include this in there? So it was a lot of, like, I think, how a good chunk of the indie tabletop role-playing game scene has sort of got involved in it, which was moving from something big and normative like Dungeons and Dragons and then going into other systems and being like, these are way better. These have way more to offer or are more tailored towards what I'm actually looking for in a story instead of trying to constantly fit multiple, a singular sized, uniquely specific peg into every single block hole you could possibly try, which is what a lot of people try and do with like fifth edition nowadays. That was a lot of my starting experience.
All right. And as a reader, you had mentioned that this was a good excuse to go back and read something again. Did you used to be a big reader of science fiction, fantasy, and horror?
Not as much into really any of those. It's been a while since really leaving undergrad, to be honest, that I really had a chance to like dive into a lot of books. Like when I was growing up, I had a lot of like, let's say, the Harry Potter series with the author who shall remain unnamed because she does not deserve any praise anymore for anything, but a lot of the things that I would latch onto were mythologies, and like I remember this collection of horror stories by like 13, 14 horror authors who did like their take on young adult fiction, and the kinds of things that I always liked in those realms when it came to horror was psychological and the kinds of concepts like the unknown being the most terrifying thing in the world. Like the thing that is very like eldritch and cosmic horror influence, which is like, no, you need to understand there is a thing out there that will crush you without trying. You are an insignificant speck whose very mental capacity to try and understand this thing is impossibly incomparable. That's the kind of area of like horror I really like. But in terms of science fiction and fantasy, a lot of what spurred on most of my early interest for it was some extent Tolkien kind of works, though I've never actually particularly liked Tolkien that much. What spurred it on was actually a lot of different Final Fantasy games growing up, watching my brother play those. And also in terms of like reading influence, a lot of it came from, again, mythology stories. I remember a collection of Jewish Sabbath stories, actually, that my dad bought me from bookstore at one point. And a lot of those questions about what it meant to think about the fantastical were kind of more the things that I grew up with and had interest in. Like these questions about like, well, what is a story at its core when it comes to mythos? A lot of times, I would say in very white Western kind of perspectives, there's a tendency to just be like, oh, we just make up a faith because a faith people are, they don't know anything, or they make it to explain the unexplainable, but they don't actually understand what that phrase means. It's this sense of like, oh, people just make up stories to explain things. I'm like, that's usually because they have a gap in knowledge after they've already looked at the world in a very hyper complex kind of way. Like when people talk about like myths and stuff or gods, I'm like, if you're going to apply that to a world building setting, actually justify why that is. Don't just be like, people worship this thing. Why? Because they're powerful. Okay, but why does it have mystique? Why does it have a history? Why does it have power? People will talk about death because they have perspectives on death. They have philosophies on death. They have ways that they think of what it means to die, because that doesn't actually mean the same thing across cultures. So, A lot of mythology stories, a lot of those tales from fantasy elements are kind of what spurred a lot of my interest early on, is just always asking, like, why do people create stories? It's often to explain things, and it's not just because they're scared or terrified. It's coming from a place of just really trying to understand, to fill in gaps about their world. It's a very organic thing, and to me, it's very human to do storytelling and to tell stories. And that's more where a lot of my influence came from. And that came, again, a lot of mythology, a lot of faith stories. A very long answer to your question.
I would almost feel like, for example, modern D&D, where a lot of magic replaces technology, that you would have to have really rethink those mythos. You can't just have a lightning god because everybody's got a lightning bolt spell, right? So you have to really replace that with something more ineffable.
It's that, and it's also the sense of like especially for something like D&D. D&D has kind of always operated in its own kind of pseudo medieval fantasy. And the way that I always started, even early on when I was more invested in that particular system and the trappings of the system and its own genre specifics, was always asking, okay, but why is fantasy wedded to this particular image? Because for me, the kinds of things that I was doing in my own world building for the first world I ever created were like, why does it always represent, why does what constitutes a fantasy world feel so white? Why does it always feel so grounded in this particular, very skewed interpretation of a certain historical period when people have, across the world, have always had their own takes about what is magical, what is fantastic? There's whole literary genres like magical realism from Latin America that are literally playing with ideas about the line between reality and fiction. Is it's not like we don't care about it. It's just more like it's a guideline. We could have it as a thing. We could not. But that influences everything about how you approach the world. And I don't know. I agree. There's that element of like magic replaced technology, but it's also like it's a stand-in for our own social attitudes as well. And it's who we privilege as the kind of interesting people in the narrative. And when the interesting people are always the lords or the ladies or all of that, then it's just like, I don't care. You're not that interesting to me.
So, Angela, do you have any books that you would recommend that listeners of our show check out in order to get some good inspiration for their gaming?
I probably lean towards, haven't been able to look at it in full as of yet, but N.K., I think it's her author's name is N.K. Jemisin's, I think it's Burned Earth trilogy. I'm trying to remember what it was. That one was, from what I've seen a lot of folks talk about it, very good on a lot of things.
And I just looked it up. It's N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season, which is the first book in the Broken Earth
series. Broken Earth. I knew it was something Earth related. I'm like Burned Earth, Broken Earth, Shattered Earth.
One thing that's great about the fifth edition Appendix N is they include a lot of great titles. Like that one's actually included in the Appendix N list for fifth edition. It's obviously not in the original one because this is much more contemporary than the original list. But perfect. Thank you so much.
I would say that and from what my partner told me, a lot of things by Ursula Le Guin, particularly Left-Handed Darkness and such. She's one of those authors. And I would be remiss and would be revoked of all of my literary, whatever little of it that I have credibility, if I didn't mention Octavia Butler in terms of like in particular Black science fiction and speculative fiction, because it's one of those things where as much as any given writer can claim that they try and be original, any of that, particularly writers of color in an American context, we owe a lot to Black literary traditions. As much of the US like culture and business of producing art really does rely and should give more respect to a lot of like Black art traditions. Although I that might just also be my bias as a musician who loves all the music that, hey, coincidentally, a lot of it is steeped in the Black tradition. So for me, it's a tendency to default to giving way more respect to that because of the influence that people often don't acknowledge in a lot of work, particularly contemporary work.
Perfect. And we can go ahead and start chatting about the book that we're working with. And first, let's go ahead and take a look at which editions we're reading. Angela, what are you working with today?
I'm working with the e-reader edition that I got read off of Kindle from getting it on Amazon.
Perfect. I'm also working with an ebook. I've got the Bantam Spectra ebook that has this really boring cover of just like a fancy building. Nothing very exciting. But Hoy, I believe you might have the Ellen Kushner approved edition.
Right. I was reading both of my library ebook copy, but I do have the Tom Canty paperback cover from 1989. And I believe he also did the 2003 edition. It is what appears to be Richard St. Vere with his windblown cloak and a rapier. And it's a very lovely sort of pen and ink and watercolor cover. So that's what I have. And I've had it for a really long time. I have had this book for, I think, literally 30 years and never cracked it just because I've always wanted to. And I think I found it at the Strand. and it just never came up like the right opportunity to read it. So here we are.
And what cracked me up is when I posted to Twitter that that this book had won our poll, our patron poll, and we were covering it. Ellen Kushner actually responded and was because I had included that image of that cover that you have, Hoy, and she responded saying that she was glad to see us use the correct cover.
There you go.
So that is the Ellen Kushner approved cover. And before we fully go into the library, rumor has it we've got a Hygaxian word of the day.
Yes, we do. This one goes out to Adam Stiers because I neglected to go specifically looking for a word, but here we go.
Disabille.
Disabille is the state of being only partly or scantily clothed. It comes from the French word meaning undressed. And it's the nobles at the beginning of the book where they're lounging around before the business day starts, drinking chocolate and eating little bonbons in bed while people are visiting them. And it sort of really reflects the atmosphere of the hill. So, dishabille.
Perfect. So here we are in the library. We can start chatting about Ellen Kushner's Swords Point. Angela, what did you think of Swords Point?
The circle felt complete because I often feel like the testament to a good writer is how well they're able to complete their own starting points and the circle that they introduce and then close it at the end. And it felt like the book resolved in at least an enjoyable kind of way as a general reader kind of point. I have mixed feelings about it solely because I think of the contrast between how I felt towards the folks on Riverside versus the folks on the hill. So much of the language, particularly the opening, which was very striking, and it did pull me into the book in a very enjoyable way. It feels so, I can see the history of about 30 different fifth edition DMs steeped in that one single opening, especially the first few opening paragraphs. But there's a lot about the lords and the nobles and such that kind of turned me off to the book, that kept making me think every time I would get to passages about Richard St. Vierre, one of the main characters, the illustrious swordsman, I was like, why can't the book just stay here more? I just wanted more Richard St. Vierre and Alec, particularly Alec, solely because my best opinion of him and summary of him is that he is a little shit, but he's an enjoyable little shit.
Absolutely. So before these episodes, we always meet up with a bunch of our patrons who read the book and want to chat about it with us. So we had our patron book club before coming here. And it's funny because somebody else was commenting on how like they loved all the characters except Alec, because they thought Alec was just such a little brat. And I piped in and I said, I adore Alec. And part of the reason why I adore Alec is I feel like Ellen Kushner may have been inspired by Bosey. I don't know if you know who Bosey is, but he was Oscar Wilde's lover. And he was this like spoiled little shit who was just terrible to everybody. And like, he's also the reason why Oscar Wilde ended up getting in all that trouble. But it really felt like that this character was at least partly, if not wholly, inspired by Bosey.
Right. Alec felt very plausible. I felt like I've known people like Alec, fortunately not been like deeply dragged into their circles. But Alec felt very plausible. There was a weird sort of self-loathing that also reflected outward on the people around him that seemed very real.
I felt almost all, or maybe even all, I can't think of any examples that don't. I felt like they all felt very plausible. And generally, when I am reading a piece of fiction that has a bunch of characters, especially if it's like a lot of political intrigue kind of stuff, I tend to get real confused. I tend to forget which character we're with. I'm like, oh, is this the person who was in that one scene? I get very confused. I didn't hear. I thought Ellen Kushner did such a beautiful job of illustrating these characters and making them all so different and so unique that I did not struggle in this situation. But Angela, it looks like you have thoughts.
See, I did actually struggle because I was trying to tell apart which one was Horn, which one was Ferris. Which one was Tremontaine versus the wife of this person or the lover of this person? It's a testament to what felt like my general lack of enthusiasm about noble kind of characters, that when the whole first bit with who is it?
Lord Michael
Godwin.
Godwin. I was trying to remember his last name. Lord Michael Godwin was like talking about, oh, I left this lady's house who I was sleeping with and it didn't go great. I was like, I am having trouble figuring out which of these people is sleeping with who. I'm sure the answer is all of them at a certain point. But the level of political intrigue actually caught me off guard, I think, because I knew nothing about the book going into it. I was just like, okay, I want to take a look at this and let's, because this is obviously what we're going to be discussing, and see what came out of it. And I understand perhaps the intent of naming the book something like Swords Point, where when, haha, the title actually showed up in the conversation, which is my favorite thing, is the moments in books where you hear the title of the book appear in some way, was meant to represent very much, from my understanding, a kind of metaphorical, a metaphorical sense of always feeling like people are like raising swords against you and having to be ready to parry, ready to redirect, ready to be on edge and ready to defend yourself. The noble machinations didn't quite land in that way for me. It landed in the very beautiful way the descriptions of Richard St. Vierre talking of like how he would, how the writer was approaching, like talking about those moments of swordplay. Those felt mm-hmm. very beautiful, and they felt like such a, for folks who might know of a positive psych background, the concept of flow, which is that sense of like you get so engrossed in a particular activity that you almost kind of lose complete sense of the world around you. That often happens for a lot of creatives and people incredibly invested in a particular hobby or bit of work. Those moments felt like swords, like the title was merited. Like there was this sense of like Richard St. Vierre being on edge, Richard St. Vierre, like having the duel with, I think it was Applethorpe, if I'm remembering his name correctly.
Yeah, Vincent Applethorpe. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Those moments felt like the title was merited. All the political machinations didn't really clinch in for me until the very, very end with the reveal of who Alec really was, or where it was, uh-huh. to whom he belonged to. But everything else, I don't know if it's just a certain jaded or kind of cultural disinterest in anything that remotely reminds me of the Game of Thrones approach of like, we have six houses all vying for a seat of power. And those kinds of stories don't always interest me, mainly because it's this sense of like, well, so the elite are just fighting with each other and effectively dicking around as they always do. This is my everyday mm-hmm. life. This is of very little interest to me. It was more interesting to seeing how it affected things like Riverside, because Riverside, it was always so telling to see how all of them, even when Richard St. Vierre at the end was like, they all know there is a price on his head and no one wants to be the person to give him up though, because that's just not what you do over there. Because they also know that brings the guard on them.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's potentially interesting here is I love your take on it. I completely understand why the nobles would not be of much interest to you and why that's just not something that like when you're with those characters, you're really like keyed into. But it is interesting because this is the first time that I have felt like and this is our 107th episode. And I feel like this is the first time I enjoyed a book significantly more than our guest. I thought this book was so much fun. I really enjoyed it. I loved the folks in Riverside and I loved the nobles. And I'll tell you why I loved the nobles as well. The reason why I thought the noble characters were great is in our introduction to Lord Michael Godwin. We first meet him. He's crawling out of the window down the wall of like this woman who he was just having sex with. And immediately he's like, oh my God, this is like so ridiculous. This is something right out of a comedy. Like, I can't believe this is my real life right now. And he's overhearing the conversation inside and is discovering now that, that the woman he was just having sex with was actually just using him to make her husband jealous. So now he's also just like standing outside in the freezing cold, trying to get down this building, and is now feeling like kind of like weirdly used. So he escapes the estate, gets to the street, and this carriage pulls up and it's Lord Horne. And he gets into Lord Horne's carriage and he can't really see him because it's dark, but he remembers how handsome Lord Horne was when he was young. And Lord Horne is clearly making the moves on Lord Michael Godwin, which also I loved how like there's all this gay shit in there that's like just totally normalized. It isn't a big deal one way or the other, which I absolutely adore and applaud, especially for somebody who wrote this in 1987. This was very early in doing things like that in literature, at least in this kind of genre work. And then he's in the carriage with Lord Horne, and Lord Horne's making the moves on him. And Michael's like, okay, here's this like handsome guy who I remember from my childhood. And clearly this guy is actually attracted to me. Like, he thinks that I'm sexy. So sure, let's go through with this. And they go back to Lord Horne's manor, and they start making out. Things are getting hot and heavy. A servant throws open the door, and then light is on Lord Horne's face for the first time. And that's when Michael's like, oh, this guy has aged a lot more than I expected. He is not cute anymore. Who is this gross dude I'm making out with? And now he just wants to get out of there. And I just thought all of that was so fun and so funny and so real.
It was enjoyable to the extent that I was like, oh, I was not expecting anything gay related whatsoever. And the fact that Richard St. Vierre seems to very sincerely care about Alec throughout it, and Alec, begrudging little shit that he is, seemed to have actually gone through so many lengths to actually save Richard. Mm-hmm. That was interesting. The thing that oddly enough, though, that I'll probably disagree with you on, though, is that Michael was actually my least favorite character. Because
That's fine.
Mainly because of this, is that I have such a low level of patience for anything remotely like heterosexuality. Like, there is such I have such a boredom with it, because so many different paragraphs were about this sense of like, she should show interest in me. I've never really had anyone tell me no. Like, I want her to be like affectionate to me. I need to read her intentions, read her language. Am I playing this game correctly? And it feeds into
with the Duchess?
Yeah, with the Duchess. And it felt so much like a reiteration of a lot of those tropes in compulsory heterosexuality that a lot of our culture says and reiterates so often, that I was just like, oh, for the love of God, shut up. I don't want to hear your opinion about your feelings being hurt. I don't care about you being like, the hot dude is not as hot as I thought. I mean, it was more interesting than the hot lady who is once again playing up the trope of a woman's really only power is knowing how to properly manipulate a lot of the men around her. I have very little patience for that trope as well.
But I would push against that, and I would say that that is not she's not the only character who's doing that. That is also what Lord Horne is doing. That is also what Ferris is doing. Almost all of the nobles, regardless of their gender or sex, that's the game they're all playing.
No, I agree. It's just, I've heard this kind of story so much in regards to like the kind of only power that is valuable for women to have is a sense of manipulation, a temptation, and knowing how to play off of men being incompetent, essentially. Like, I've seen so much of this both in my real life and also in the kinds of stories in normative like media that says for what is valuable about women. And for me, that I never feel like that's a point of power. Because when I was thinking about this book and its in all of its different parts, and I think about who were like the movers and shakers and the people who had quote unquote real power in it, I never really felt quite like the Duchess up until the end. And even then it was like, what is the foundation of her power? It's knowing how to keep certain things close and knowing how to manipulate people. And what the bedrock upon which that rests on in terms of assumptions about what women's roles are and their power are, that was kind of the thing that rubbed me the wrong way. And it's kind of a thing where, again, I'm just like, if it were Richard St. Vierre, if it was Madame Renee St. Vierre and her lover, I would have been more interested. But that's solely also my lesbian bias showing very, very clearly as well. Like, I want more women in the focus of the power. More predominantly, I'm just kind of tired of a lot of the sense that like she had to play around a lot of these men and to even demonstrate that power, if that makes sense.
I mean, I don't think Alan Cushman is playing into this or believes these things. It's more that she's making commentary about this kind of structures that people have existed throughout time, right? And obviously it's very tiring to see it constantly, but it's still a commentary on it rather than just like an embrace of it, right? Or at least that's my reading of this book. They're playing a lot, but still, like, okay, is Ginny Ginny also? There is one swordswoman, one character who is a swordsman. It's Ginny, right? Or is it?
trying to remember. There's a lot of names.
I don't remember her name. I know there was Jessamine, who was the like famous thief. Yeah, in Riverside, but we don't actually really like. I don't think we ever see her. I think we just hear about her.
I believe that Ginny was a swordswoman. Was also a swordswoman, even though she was managing Hugo. But you know that she was not absolute top, but she was quite competent.
Yeah, but I would side with Angela just on the sense that like the examples you're bringing up are examples of characters who are mentioned in passing, but they are not given narrative spotlight.
Right. Well, that's not even really where I was getting in terms of like it being counter example. I was just saying that I wonder if that in the context of when this was written, it still would have been one step too far to be again Rachel St. Vere, given everything else that's going on. Okay, here's one barrier we can break, but we can't just crash through everything like the Kool-Aid Man. Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because the idea of a powerful female swordswoman is something we've seen since Jorel of Jouarie in the 1930s. It was not as common as like the Conans out there, but that is not groundbreaking. What was groundbreaking was that it's 1987 and we're at the height of the AIDS epidemic, mm-hmm. and the country is so incredibly homophobic. And here is Ellen Kushner writing a incredible story about two men in love and making it not something that is about, because I'm 41 years old. I am a gay man. I remember when I was young, every piece of gay media that I had, that I came in contact with, either had one partner being gay bashed to death or one partner dying of AIDS. Every piece of gay media was about gay bashing or AIDS. At least that was my experience.
Right, you had to sanctify your gays in order to make it acceptable.
And here's 1987, the height of that kind of stuff. And there's none of that there. This is just like a beautiful, fun little story that's being told where being gay is super normalized. And I really wish I had found this when I was younger.
It is normalized in a sense, but I think the pushback I would have to that, though, is for whom is it normalized is the question I would ask in response to that, though, because
for the gay men who are dying of AIDS in 87.
No. I understand that. Like, because I agree, because like thinking about that context, that was something that I was bearing in mind. I was like, gay relationship in this is still the aftermath in the midst of the tail end of the like AIDS crisis and moving on, where like folks not having ascent, there's a lot of the specter of that death clinging.
Yeah, and in 87 we still didn't have good medications for it, so like it was still a death sentence in 87.
Yes, there is that, but and this gets into other aspects of just the depictions in the book as well that stuck with me. It's for whom is that normalized? It was a fairly rich, white, non-disabled pair of men of a certain age range and such. It's because the book in certain passages, these are the ones that stuck out to me, were like when they're talking about at one point a swordsman who is like, she does Kushner does not use this exact language, but is like the implication is like a swordsman loses their arm who is effectively maimed is a worse than someone who dies, because at least when they die they have glory. But if they're maimed at the top of their game, then they're useless. And I'm like, that's very telling about the writer's perspective on who gets to be valuable or talented in that world. It's a normalization.
I disagree, because I feel like Ellen Kushner was saying that is the perception of all these people, that in this world, people assume that if you've lost your arm, you are no longer worth a damn. And here is a character who has lost his arm and is still an incredible swordsman who is still kicking ass. And like, yes, he can't beat the literal best swordsman in the world and ends up dying, but the person who kills him is the best swordsman in the world.
Right. But it feels as though it's still relying on the sense of the extraordinary person as opposed to a normalization of the people. It's right. Asking for, because okay. I think there's a contrast between that and the presentation of like homosexuality and homosexual relationships or just gay relationships, because I think for gayness as a factor, that is true. It does feel normalized. It's not like within the larger social stratum, there is a sense of like, oh, Alec and Richard, they're just together. Alec is a little shit who cheats at gambling any chance he gets. The nobles fuck around with each other. and certain people absolutely don't like porn versus
being right gay is not a big deal in this world, but being disabled is.
Exactly.
There. And it might have been exciting to have also seen a story where all these other things were just as normalized right as the exactly gay stuff. Is that what you're
saying? Yeah. Right. Okay. That's interesting. That's right. That to me also affects the element of why I have that perspective in regards to like how women are treated. Cause mm-hmm what's the, like in terms of like, what's the first, I think, female character's name literally referred to as, I think, Marie the Whore.
Yeah.
That's our starting point for women characters in this book. I'm right not saying that's all of them, nor does it encompass the complexity of all the characters.
Well, in fairness, it was Marie the Whore and Laundress.
Not making it right any better. You have somehow made it worse.
Right. So I see a little middle ground here between Angela and Jeff, what you're talking about, at least with regards to Vincent Applegate. Not so much I have left to say at the moment on my thoughts about the women characters. And I think that one way to look at the depictions and you know, Angela, I think you sort of push back against this valorizing of this sort of physical perfection and this sort of false heroism is one of the things that is not really ring true for you. I think this is actually a commentary on the sort of a little of the toxicity of this dualist mindset, the gunslinger mindset, the all of that, is that they do internalize it so much that they do think that they're worthless if they lose an arm. And it's actually a commentary like that. Even Vincent Applegate, who seems like incredibly wise man, he's a wise teacher, he's all these things, but he also realized that he's nothing, that or at least in his mind, he's internalized that he is nothing unless he can create a great student and that he can die in glory against the best swordsman of the age, right? And that's a toxic thing to think, right? Like, it's better for me to die like spewing blood than like in my bed, warm bed, right?
Right. It is unsurprisingly a very bad sentiment of a lot of toxic masculinity as well. So I would agree with you on that one, Hoyt. I think that's right. A very good counterpoint, or at least a good like qualifying point to keep in mind in relation right to all of this.
And this is probably a good time for us to transition our conversation to the gaming side, just to make sure that we actually have an opportunity to
of course, part of
the conversation as well. So looking at this from a gaming perspective, now, Angela, I know that you are very into world building from what you were saying before. I'm curious, did the world building Ellen Kushner did, was it what about that worked for you? What about it do you think we could use to incorporate that we could take from this and incorporate into our gaming?
Personalities, mm-hmm, character, like as even if I didn't think some of them were memorable, so much of Riverside was so clearly marked out as a place, as both a physical, like when you're writing and creating worlds where you can use the physical topography that the topography that you're creating in it to help demonstrate the social and economic and larger like institutional lines about the world you're creating, that to me is such a good thing to do. Because oftentimes I found when I was younger, I didn't think about geography until like, I think it was like high school. I had an AP US history course and my teacher was just like, okay, notice where all these states are. I'm like, okay, what is it? It's like, what do they go alongside? It's like, oh, the mountains. It's like, why are certain communities, certain attitudes and such might be happening? Because natural topography affects the concerns on the local level, the concerns about how you structure mm-hmm certain things or what becomes your priorities. Okay, what was the North economy based around? Like, well, it couldn't have the same kind of agriculture that the South would have. Just those little points made me think about the world and like what people's live like concerns in the world would be. So I think those elements of just opening up the paragraphs of the story with that sense of like, here is Riverside. This is a place where the cold is literally getting through some of these broken windows where you mm-hmm have it a case where, who is that? Oh, he just killed someone at a party over there. I'm sorry? Yeah, no, he just killed somebody at a party. He actually killed two people at a party.
Right.
He's a nice guy. I've played cards with him. Like that's such a right good way of establishing, of just cementing in like what is this world we're in? Because right, right, so yeah much of what it means to speak to a genre of the world that you're building in is about tropes. And now I know I keep using tropes in the kind of negative sense, but I will give also a charitable like olive branch to the concept of tropes, and that tropes are just there. I guess this is coming from like my musician background. I think of it tropes akin to like how folk songs work in a way because they're like, what is this? Oh, here's, you need four chords. Okay, that's fine. What do we do? Here's a melody. Oh, that's not very hard. Yeah, make up whatever you want to the lyrics. It's like, really? It's like, yeah, just do that. And it's like, okay, talk about local things. That's what a trope really is. Sometimes it doesn't land because it feels overused or it's not something that catches people. And other times a trope works because it helps cement what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And if you were doing a noir one, if I told you, if I opened up with the air was thick with a scent of burnt out cigarettes and kind of a heavy scent of bourbon, clothes wearing on my back were probably haven't been washed in 3 days. And there's a sense of mystery and intrigue in the air, but also a sense of exhaustion just clinging to my body. That's a very different tone and very different world I'm bringing you into about the character and everything around them and how they see it than Kushner's opening of like blood dripping on a perfectly white snow, bed of snow. So I think those elements in terms of like pulling for your own GMing world building, a clear sense of how topography affects and brings you and your players into the world, and also just clear personalities. Opening with Michael Godwin, as much as I did not like him as a character, opening with the freaking hilarious, I'm leaving the room that I just slept with someone in, and I'm currently hanging on a on a pipe while she's talking to her husband out in her room. Right. It's hilarious. It's absurd. And it gives you a sense of what this man's priorities probably were and the mistakes he's obviously made.
Right. And you mentioned specificity. And Jeff, this was specificity that you mentioned in the book club. The very fact that there was no more ivy on the building because it was out of fashion. So he couldn't cling to the ivy. He'd been pulled down. So he's clinging to this freezing pipe. Right.
Yeah. Right. Which is, again, a great piece of world building. Absolutely. Yeah. And it was, and I was saying that based on that, I would love to have somebody make like a D100 or maybe even a D1000 table of all of like the things that could go in or out of style in town. And you roll on the table once to see what's currently in fashion. You roll on the table again to see what's out of fashion. And on the off chance you end up rolling the same thing twice, then it's something that like is totally gauche and out of style, but some people are trying real hard to bring back. I think that could be fun. But speaking of Riverside as like world building, I loved the idea, and I think we can fully steal this and put this into any of our urban gaming, especially in kind of like fantasy gaming. This like this section of town where the guard doesn't go there, the watch doesn't go there. From everybody else's perspective, it is this like decadent place of thieves. But she also specifically says, the people who live there, like to think of themselves as evil, but really they're no worse than anyone else. I loved that. But also specifically within Riverside, there was one bit of world building I loved, and that was the old market. And I highlighted the text here. It says, the old market wasn't old, nor was it properly a market. A square of once elegant houses had been gutted at the ground floor so that each house opened at the front. The effect was like a series of little box stage sets, each containing a fire and a group of Riversiders crowded around it, their hands stuffed under their armpits or held out to the fire, engaged in what could only loosely be termed as marketing. A little dicing, a little flirting, drinking, and trying to sell each other stolen objects, shifting from foot to foot in the cold. I love that. I want to put Riverside and specifically the old market into like whatever next urban adventure I run.
That felt like such a good element of world building too, because it gives you a sense of the priorities of people. Because I think part of what works really well with world building is if you give a sense of like, why the hell would someone even do this? Mm-hmm. If you're including that. And that one, it made perfect sense to include something like that, because the whole area has the sense of like, look, we won't fuck with you if you don't fuck with us. Also, we don't care that much about legality, but we also kind of need a spot to not be freezing outside, but we don't really want to do this formal because we're not like those people, which I felt like is a kind of a nice inversion of itself, that Riverside, as much as they might take on or feed the perception of them as all being like rabble rousers and stuff, they know that probably some of the more monstrous people are the ones up on the hill, not them.
Right, right. Well, it's also telling that Riverside is the former rich district, so they occupy all those former mansions, and they're squatting in all these former mansions, right? And it's like this peeling wallpaper and these magnificent ballrooms that they're living in. And so that level of specificity, it's not some generic medieval slum that just has, you know, like piss running down the alleyway, right?
Yeah.
it's literally someone at some point had to have thought the idea, there's an old house there. No one's fucking using it.
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
Yep.
Do we need to destroy the whole thing and revenerate it? No. We don't do that. We just need it to be functional. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. We'll figure out once we're drunk or after we have a spot to drink and flirt with people.
Oh, and speaking of which, each of the taverns in the story was different and had a specific purpose, right? The brown dog is the one where like the nobles come to kind of slum because it's the one that's close to the bridge, right? And like people get fleeced. And then there's this other one that's in the business district, so no one goes there at night. So that's where the people go if they don't want to get recognized. So there was, instead of just your generic fantasy tavern, right? There's like, you know, we all have our spots. This is the spot we go to when we're feeling like this. This is the spot when we go to when we want to do this and we don't want to, you know. And so that, again, that level of specificity I thought was really, really, really terrific.
Yeah. And I say this as someone who at times has a certain level of difficulty with memory and such for a lot of the details even I create or write. Specificity can help. Specificity helps bring you into just knowing a certain spot to be able to riff off of the rest of it that you create with others. And also, like, it's just so goddamn charming at some points when you create something where you're just like, why is this so hyper-specific? And who would even relate to that? The funny thing is, sometimes when you get super incredibly hyper-specific, oddly enough, more people actually understand that feeling. Because if you describe, let's choose a very like oddly specific thing. It's like the weather was the kind of gray that sunlight had not ever poked out of it other than like a hedgehog being very afraid of, no, than a groundhog being afraid of seeing its own shadow. That's such an oddly specific like phrasing. But you know exactly what it means. It's just like, me, yeah. I don't want to look at this.
Yeah, it's like there's actually a sentence I also highlighted where she was talking about some of the rich noble ladies. And she says, the tips of their fingers, round and smooth, peeped continually through the lace like little pink shells.
It's such a, I do want to give credit to her, like in the points that I want to applaud the book for. Her descriptions are very good.
Her prose is gorgeous.
Prose is very, very good. Like when it came to describing them, regardless if what she did with some of the characters or what have you, I didn't necessarily care for, the prose was very pretty. And again, it is both a begrudging, but also very enthusiastic, but also like still like sincere acknowledgement that I give to the book's credit that like, if I can say, I see like 30 other GMs and DM styles of giving a world its life through the kind of prose that's here. That's a testament to the quality of the writing, I think, because if I remember a GM's descriptions, it's probably because they were halfway decent.
And Hoy, was there anything particular from this book that you wanted to steal that you think would be fun to put into a game?
I mean, so much, obviously. Again, you know, we always have this generic fantasy city, and the model for that is like, you know, the Fritz Leiber's, you know, Lankmar, right, in many regards. But this is a totally different take. This is high and low as well, but this is not that city. So it's a way of saying, okay, well, this city is very much its own thing. There's that mix between high and low. And the interesting thing is maybe that interzone where people meet, or the people who travel between the two zones, like Catherine, you know, who is Ferris's, you know, lover. And so I'm really fascinated about that. And I could see how it's such a rich environment that, you know, the things, as Angela, you mentioned, you know, you have no interest in what's happening on the hill, but Riverside itself is so rich, you could continue doing that with Riverside. On the other hand, if people don't want to look at that environment and they really are interested in those parlor backroom machinations or leading up to elections, that there's that is available too. And so it really sort of really, to me, this city feels really alive. And again, that's credit to the specificity. And as Angela, you mentioned, when you get super, super specific, people, you can relate that. Like, oh, yeah, that did feel like February, last February, when you mentioned that hedgehog.
I have not seen the sun.
Exactly. I mean, maybe someone from Tahiti wouldn't have that understanding, but then they would still know it was something pretty dramatic.
So first off, I do want to say I did Google Swords Point RPG to see if there was one, and there is, but it's not based on this. It's a swashbuckling game called Swords Point. But
unsurprising.
But let's pretend there was an RPG that was specifically set in this world. And Angela, you were going to play a character in Riverside because Riverside's the area that you're interested in. Do you have a sense as to what kind of character you might want to play in the Riverside game?
That is a good question, actually. I might have to steal that question for other time, for icebreakers for later conversations I have with friends. I'm trying to remember who was, I think it might have been Ginny, who was like one of the like the tavern tavern women, who was like effectively being like, yeah, Richard,
yeah,
please don't go. Please, you're gonna, yeah, this is gonna be bad for you. Oh, he's gonna go do it. All right, fine. Yep. Like that person, solely because I know that kind of personality type is one I get along with very well and can do very well. But two, that's the personality of someone who's like, there are 12 people around me who are going to make a fool of themselves. This will both A, be a thing I have to clean up, but B, this will make for interesting stories. I like the kind of people where you're like, oh, you don't have that interesting a job. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. Anyone in a quote unquote support role usually has a lot of stories to share. And I love those kinds of personalities, because people are like, oh, what use is just a common person who just talks to a lot of people? I talk to a lot of people. It means I know a lot of things. And
yeah,
and also, especially the kind of person who people give begrudging respect to is an archetype, yeah, I love, because you're like, I don't care where you come from. You need information from me. So as much as insignificant financially as I am to you, you are not the one in power here. I am actually the one in power, which is, I love that as a kind of role to be able to take on. Just someone who's like, I don't have any power, secretly has all the power.
Absolutely. All right. And it's about time to start wrapping up. Angela, do you have any final thoughts about Swords Point that you would like to share before we wrap this episode up?
I think that considering the context it was written in, at least in terms of time period, and also the playfulness of the prose, and despite my disinclination towards kind of political intrigue, it was an enjoyable book. And I think the best things to pillage, archive, pull from it are the kind of frankness of putting forward the character personalities. Keep that, like, you don't need to, like, as much as I didn't necessarily like the machinations that happened and how they played out in the book, the sense in which, like, it was clear, oh, it's going to be one of those kinds of stories, that kind of blatant bluntness about it, that is a good thing, I think, to have. Like, so much of what I've seen in GMs who do poorly, and also players to a certain extent as well, for creating a table that makes a long form game possible, so much of what they do bad at is trying to be like, I think it's epitomized in a phrase I think a friend said at one point, that was like, so you revealed your tragic backstory, what now? it's that sense of like, you're holding on to details to, because you think like, oh, the reveal will be the most important part, and you don't think about anything past that. It's like, okay, well, what happens if the whole reveal happens?
Right.
Make it interesting along the way. Make your characters interesting along the way. Be bold with your choices, which, considering one of the bold choices here was to make a blatantly like established like homosexual relationships and gay love being a thing, just kind of standardized, that's a good thing. And that is also the other thing that I am required as a gay and as a trans to indicate that, yes, more gay stuff. More gay stuff. More gay stuff.
More gay, please.
More gay stuff is also the takeaway.
So, Angela, are you working on any projects right now you would like our listeners to be aware of?
Yes, actually. I am in the midst of being involved in a Kickstarter that is going to be going live very soon for the Slayer's Almanac project. For folks who do not know what the Slayer's Almanac project is, or even what Slayer's is an RPG that is very rules light, where the whole premise is, hey, you are a monster hunter. You, in the stock setting, the baseline book setting, you play monster hunters roaming a city that is cursed to forever expand and have districts that are endless. The books, in contrast to how a lot of other systems do their kind of playbook styles of trying to talk about balance, the mindset of the game's creator, Spencer Campbell, was, we don't do that here. We do asymmetrical playbooks, which is to say, like, you have a gunslinger, a tactician, a blade, and an arcanist. None of them play like each other. The only unifying rule is that it's 4 and above on a roll is a success. Other than that, the blade has a exploding dice kind of mechanic. The arcanist has a risk reward factor. The gunslinger can let off 6 shots and then has to use their abilities to reload their weapon. They all play differently. That's Slayer's in a nutshell. Cool. The Slayer's Almanac project is Spencer Campbell has gotten together 10 distinct writers to create 10 distinct districts for Very Slayers cool. itself, and I'm going to be one of the writers where I'm making cool. a district that I got to first debut with a bunch of other, with an entire full table of POC players called Yanis, based off the Greek god of transitions and doorways, that is essentially, it's a city that was established allegedly on the body of a dead phoenix. So whole sections of the city shift and change, and people's memories of those districts that change and fade away also fade with them. So there are entire libraries and sections where people act as what are called scholars of disappearance to try and remember and archive the little bits of memory that are still being clung on to. That's one district, and that's not going over all the other districts that include, I think there's a Southeast Asian refugee ethnic enclave. There is a South Asian mysticism sort of community enclave. There's a hag enclave. There's a creative arts, jazz, beat poets, dive bar kind of district. There's a lot of amazing writers, but this is for the Slayers Almanac project that I believe it's launching on October 12th and will be going for until the end of October, if not a little bit beyond, but I'm super excited to be on it.
I'm sad to say that this episode is going to be airing on November 15th, but when this episode airs, will people still be able to sign up for stuff?
I think they will. And also, I think by that point, the Slayers projects have also, the Slayers games are still always available on itch.io, right, which is a common website to sell them. And also, sure. mm-hmm. my playbooks are available on there because I am the fool who decided, hey, I like Final Fantasy a lot. I'm going to make 17 playbooks for this system based off of Final Fantasy. And I did it. And it was a lot of work. And they mostly work. And
there
I'm
you
go. Proud.
So, Angel, how should we find you on Itch and on the social media then? What's your handle there?
Phoenix24Femme on Twitter is where you can find me. You can find my professional writing and my poetry. Currently, I have at the time of this recording, but probably by the time it's actually published, over 210 poems on the Patreon, half of which are available for public viewing at Philosophem. And I also do music commissions at angela.lemusmagrejo22@gmail.com. And also, I'm involved in terms of streaming over at All Nerds Here and Hutopia on Twitch. And if you want to catch my game design stuff, which I have a new game that will hopefully be out by the start of November, over on Voice of the Phoenix, itch.io, you can find my work there.
There you go. Angela, master of all media.
I do a lot of things. I don't actually remember all of them until someone's like, what do you do? Like, what do you want to hype up? And I'm like, here's 10 things. Do any of these work?
Perfect.
Perfect. And I want to go ahead and give a shout out to our patrons. Thank you so much for your support. If you would like to show a little bit of your support, if you like the show, please head on over to patreon.com/appendixnbookclub. Our patrons are able to listen to the patron book club's recording, the patron book club recordings that we do before these. They're also able to participate in them. The patrons who participated in today's recording are Dan Alexander, our logo designer, Rick Byrne, Joseph Hoopman, and Adam Stiers. Thank you all so much for hanging out with us earlier today. I would also like to give a shout out to a few of our other patrons as well. Jeremy Harper, Gabriel Laycock, Jarrell Johnson, Michael Carnes, Dave Hotstream, Trevor Stamper, and Peter Martino. Thank you all so much for your support.
Thank you.
And our patrons get to choose which books we're going to be covering on our future episodes. And when this episode drops, we will have the poll available for episode 117. And the options that you can vote on for that episode are Marion Zimmer Bradley's The Planet Savers, Emma Bull's War for the Oaks, Neil Gaiman's Stardust, and Clark Ashton Smith's The End of the Story. So those will be the four options that are up for a vote for episode 117. Also, the results are in for episode 113. Our topic is going to be Michael Moorcock's The Jewel in the Skull. So that should be some exciting stuff. And Hoy, where can folks find us online?
All right. If you like us, please rate us and review us on your podcatcher of choice, such as iTunes. If you want to give us some feedback, you can drop us an email at appendixnbookclub@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at appendix_n.
And Angela, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an honor to have you on the show.
It's been an honor to be involved with this show. I appreciate the rapport we all managed to create here. And it's always good to get to talk about fantastic world building and fantasy and beyond. Thank you for having me on.
Angela, yes. really appreciate having you on. I really, your point of view, your advocacy is really tremendous. It really made me think about this book in a different way as well, too. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
See you in a sec.
Read on.
The library is closed.